You're listening to Midori House, first broadcast on the 18th of July, 2016, on Monocle 24. Hello and welcome to Midori House, coming to you live from Studio One here in London. I'm Andrew Tuck. On today's show...
The United States is not harboring anybody. We're not preventing anything from happening. We've never had a formal request for extradition. We need a solid legal foundation that meets the standard of extradition in order for our courts to approve such a request.
After a failed coup in Turkey, we'll be looking at why the nation is pointing the finger of blame at a cleric based in the US. Also coming up, we'll reflect on the current state of US policing and politics as three officers are killed in Baton Rouge. And we'll be asking why Nice residents booed the French Prime Minister Manuel Valls today. That's all to come on Midori House with me, Andrew Tuck. So, welcome to Midori House. My guests today are Phil Clark, reader in comparative and international politics at SOAS, University of London, and Mary Jajewski, columnist for The Independent and also The Guardian. Welcome both to the programme. On Friday, the world watched as Turkey's military coup unfolded across the nation, led by a small faction of the nation's armed forces. Order was restored and the coup failed. But 294 people died and President Recep Tayyip Erdogan has now ordered a purge of those responsible. He's pointed the finger firmly at Fethullah Gulen, a cleric and a leader of the Hizmet movement who is exiled from Turkey in the US. Turkey wants to extradite him, but the US wants proof of his complicity. John Kerry has said, "We would invite the government of Turkey, as we always do, to present us with any legitimate evidence that withstands scrutiny." In a moment, we'll debate why Gulen is a power player in Turkey. But first, let's recap the weekend's events. Monocle's Chris Lord was covering the chaos as it unfolded from our Istanbul bureau.
Well, we're getting very, very splintered reports about what's actually going on here in Istanbul at the moment. But it seems that a faction within the military here has actually attempted to seize control and has now actually claimed on television that it has seized control of the country. Bridges have been closed within Istanbul and there's been aircraft flying low over Ankara over the last hour. Lots of scenes of panic, especially on major infrastructure like bridges, and people are also trying to work out exactly what's going on in terms of the government's control of power here at the moment. President Erdogan has now come out and towards sort of about just after 1 a.m. Turkey time, he actually delivered a speech to the Turkish people via FaceTime, and in which he urged people in Turkey to convene at public spaces. He told them to go out to airports, to squares, and he said that there's no power higher than the power of the people.
So here in Taksim Square, it really sums up some of the moment right now in the aftermath of yesterday's failed coup here in Turkey. There's hundreds and hundreds of young men, all draped in Turkish flags, singing a combination of nationalistic songs and shouting Allahu Akbar.
This is the last step, the last stage of the dark ages of Turkey, of the military dictatorship in Turkey, and we are coming very close to 100% democracy in this country.
Well, there we have it. That was our Chris Lord, who was in Istanbul during the failed coup on Friday and is, of course, still there reporting for us. Phil, listening to that and watching the events unfold on Friday, the finger has been pointed by the Turkish president at Fethullah Gulen. But you know, he says, from his safety in Pennsylvania, nothing to do with me. And the US seems to be, at this stage, kind of backing him up in a sense, saying, you know, we need to see a lot of proof before we move against him.
Yeah, we heard it in those comments from John Kerry, that this very legalistic line, we won't act until we see very hard evidence. And I think this shows a certain suspicion on the US's part that in fact Gulen is behind this. And I think even if Gulen were behind it, it would be very difficult to prove. This is perfect for Erdogan. He can basically make these big claims about a faceless entity in the background who's fomenting trouble on the ground, but won't actually have to come out with any hard proof to back that claim up. And in the meantime, he can go ahead and use the coup as a basis for eradicating a whole lot of elements within the military and within the government that he's wanted to get rid of for a very long time. So it's an extremely convenient tactic that he's using here.
Mary, it's intriguing because there are several narratives here which are complicated, but have all oddly played into the hands of Erdogan. This there's always talk of, you know, conspiracies of, you know, a shadow state, and for most part, people have felt, you know, come on, nothing like that is happening. And now it seems that there has been, you know, proof that there was a plot, there were people in the shadows who wanted to pull down Erdogan. But that doesn't necessarily mean that it's Gulen that did it, because he's a religious figure, and these military people who took part in the coup, they were definitely fighting for a more secular state.
Yes, and you look at it, I mean, it is very, very strange, as you say. I mean, first of all, there have been rumours that maybe one of the reasons for US reluctance to have anything to do with extradition beyond the strictly legal process is that maybe the US actually wanted to make difficulties for Erdogan. Now, you know, I don't particularly subscribe to that, but, you know, given that there are so many different theories around, you can't immediately jettison that particular one. There's also the fact that is known that Gulen and Erdogan made common cause in the past. This is one of the ways that Erdogan reached power in the first place. The two split, not necessarily, it appears, over their differences in relation to Islam, but now they're obviously sworn enemies, and as Patrick said, you know, it's extremely useful to Erdogan. But I think we heard from, you know, the spectacular sort of audio summary of what went on in the early hours of Saturday morning. I mean, this was huge drama, and it wasn't at all clear, you know, between sort of 11 o'clock in the evening UK time and 3 o'clock in the morning, it wasn't at all clear what was going to happen, whether this was a coup that had succeeded or whether Erdogan was going to win. And one of the ways he won, as you know, you were saying, he brought people out on the streets, and people who are sympathetic to the sort of influence of Islam on government and the people who are steadfastly opposed to it nonetheless join forces to defend the state. And in a way, I think, you know, to me that seems like quite a good vindication of modernism in Turkey.
Yes, because Phil, we should remember that while the those leading the coup said, you know, this was, you know, to bring back democracy, to usher back in a more secular state, that actually in the past, when we've had, you know, a military regime in Turkey, it's been brutal. I mean, it's seen the worst of times, with people vanishing, with political prisoners, with a kind of brutality that is very, very difficult to stomach.
And it seems we're going to see much more of that in the next week or two, that Erdogan already, in this crackdown against elements within his own government, within the military, seems to be reverting to precisely those kind of tactics. So I think the fear at the moment in Turkey would be that all of those people who came out on the streets in support of Erdogan so quickly after the coup was announced, now are, I assume, going to look on with a great sense of horror as the full machinery of the state is brought to bear against anybody who looks like an opponent to the current regime. And what will the population think about that? I mean, I agree with Mary that this is a remarkable moment to see different factions, different sides of politics banding together to support the state in the way that they did over the weekend. But what will the popular reaction be as this crackdown continues over the next week or two, as it surely will, given events in the last day or two?
And Mary, you know, that's an interesting point, but it does feel like all of these, you know, all of these terrible challenges are going to leave him in a more powerful position. On Monocle 24, we've covered, you know, over the last couple of years, all of the actions taken against journalists. And there's always a sense that, you know, he kind of tries to distance himself. He says, no, 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 that's the government, it's not me. But in the background, you have a real sense of him being, you know, a very kind of slightly autocratic figure who would like to take more and more power, who wants to have more, you know, presidential powers. But it's not looking good for moderate, you know, non-religious Turks at the moment.
No, and the measures that have been taken so far. I mean, you know, we've got 3,000 members of the military apparently in detention. We've got 3,000 members of the judiciary in detention. We've got parts of the police force in detention. Now, that's before you even start on the journalists. So that I don't think that the prospects for the moment look as though Erdogan has been given a spectacular pretext for clamping down. But on the other hand, I mean, as Phil was just saying, I mean, once the people who were called out on the street have a sense that maybe they can turn the tide of history, this is a dangerous moment as well as being a promising one.
Well, we're going to leave that there. Chris Lord, who's our correspondent in Istanbul, will be covering the story as it unfolds over the week. Now, we're going to stay in the US, though, for the time being, because despite the global news focus turning to the terrible events in Nice and the drama unfolding in Turkey over the weekend, it's all too easy to overlook the continuing unrest in the US aimed towards the police. The latest violent encounter has seen three officers shot in Baton Rouge, Louisiana, yesterday. The violence means that security is also tight as Republican hopeful Donald Trump prepares to address the Republican convention in Cleveland today. Mary, you've covered US politics. What is going on, do you think? You know, the level of violence, it feels that it's each side or many sides are now so anxious and at a certain level that it's kind of feeding off each side in a slight frenzy.
I think it's one of the worst times for race relations and relations between black Americans and the mostly white police forces that I can almost remember since the really bad times. It looks as though with the deliberate shooting, corralling and shooting of white police officers because they're police and because they're white, you've got, you know, it's a conflict that goes way back in America, but it's one that has been sort of from time to time, it reaches a climax and then it gets so bad that something happens and all sorts of policy initiatives are taken and then it sort of goes off the boil for a while. But this seems to me to be of a slightly different order, not least because America's liberal gun laws, the disparity is being pointed out between the treatment of blacks carrying weapons and white Americans carrying firearms, and that both have the absolute right under the Constitution to do so, and the states have the jurisdiction about how far that goes. But you cannot, no American administration can say that a black American cannot carry a weapon in the same state where it's legal for a white American to carry a weapon. And that's a contradiction that I haven't seen brought to the surface before. And it, in some ways, it's sort of morbidly fascinating. And in the other, you see it's incredibly dangerous. Because one of the things I could never understand, I spent 5 years living in Washington, traveling all over the United States. And one of the things I could never really understand was why on earth Black America had never risen in organized revolt against power in Washington, against the administration, because it seemed to me that all the ingredients had been there for so long, and yet it never actually happened.
Phil, it's interesting. You know, we've had this is a sidestep, but it is. You know, we had a vote here about Brexit in the UK, and we know what happened there. There was a feeling that actually liberal-minded people sitting in central government, which were David Cameron, they didn't have any problems really with people's race or gender or sexuality. But actually, that liberal view didn't filter out beyond a very small milieu and a very kind of one city, in a sense. You know, people in the rest of the country didn't feel caught up in it. Here we are in the US. We have the first black American president. You'd think this would be the ultimate time when
those views, and he's, you know, for us in the West, he seems like an extraordinary character. You know, he's done amazing things. And there are black police officers. You know, one of the people killed is Montrell Jackson, you know, a black police officer who said, you know, I love my city, but I don't know whether my city loves me. You know, he knew the risks and the dangers. So it's a little bit more complicated than that. But actually, when you get, as Mary says, when you get down to, like, you know, the black neighborhoods of Washington, or when you get out to Cleveland, or when you get out to any of these other cities, then suddenly those race relations are riven and dangerous in a way that is really hard to understand how nothing has shifted.
And it must be one of the great miseries of Obama's presidency that despite his constant calls for reconciliation across the racial divide, almost none of this has had any major effect on the way that whites and blacks in the U.S. live together. And I think these recent events have really brought that to the fore. But I think these shootings in Dallas and Baton Rouge have brought out a couple of other features. I think obviously the most obvious one is the racial divide. I think another one is this hypocrisy around gun ownership that Mary points to. But what's also important is that both of the perpetrators in the two places were also ex-servicemen. And I think it's also put a real spotlight on the damage done domestically in the US by the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan, and the damage that was done to individual soldiers, the trauma. And I think what we're seeing in the last 6 or 7 months is the playing out of a multiplicity of factors coming together. It's race has always been there. That sense of black despondency and black anger has always been there. But the things that are overlaid seem to be the things that have led to the violence. So it's things like the political atmosphere and Trump's rhetoric and this whole build-up to the elections, which is absolutely toxic. It is this very unusual overlay of Iraq and Afghanistan on top of these racial issues. And this year seems to be the one where we've got this really toxic brew of factors. Something very different is going on this year.
And you could maybe add to that we're in the tail end of Obama's presidency, and that maybe any hope that anybody had at the outset that there would be any improvement significantly in race relations because there was a black president, this is not going to come about. This is now clear.
And also, Mary, do you feel, you know, let's talk, you know, Donald Trump is going to be, as we said, you know, speaking at the convention later on today. Do you get some sense, you know, that, again, you know, we're talking about how strange, you know, twists and turns kind of end up playing into the hands of people. You know, these shootings, you know, for Trump to win, he needs to get out the white working class vote in a way that's never been seen before. And we're beginning to think that he has that ability to get people to vote who have not voted before. And then, you know, I spoke to a few people recently who are looking at, you know, politics through in the US, academics who are saying, do you know what, he has a real potential because of the way he's motivating people. And when you see these incidents, this is, you know, he doesn't actually have to speak with hyperbole anymore. He doesn't have to speak in anger. His constituency are glued to this story.
Yes, and it plays to so many things so deep in America. And it's, you know, it's as much as a gift to him politically. You know, we were talking about Erdogan and the gift to him. And you looked at it. The same tendency. You see this all over. You go back to the Brexit vote in the UK. It's the same thing of enormous discontent suddenly having an outlet, and that's why, you know, it's so riveting to watch from the outside, but also a sort of gratifying in a way that we're not immediately involved.
And just tell me, you know, as a former Washington hand. The election, you know, the selection rather of a running mate, Pence. You know, what did you make of him?
Made of him that he looks like an absolute, complete non-entity. Other than that, it looks as though he can bring with him the Christian fundamentalist vote in the white South, which is something that Trump couldn't count on himself.
And well, lastly, quickly, as an old Washington hand. Do you think that Trump can win?
I've thought that Trump could win from quite an early stage, and I still think he could win.
And what's your view, Phil, when you watch this? You know, this, because, you know, we're going to touch on two or three stories here where I feel that there are some, you know, there are some points which join them all up, and one of them is, you know, is just the same thing. You know, this ability to motivate suddenly people through popular politics. You know, we've seen that with, you know, Erdogan. We're just talking about that there, and we're going to move into France in a moment, where again that same kind of thing comes up. There's something happening that's almost kind of global, and I don't think, you know, there's probably a few people who feel they've got a hand on it, or they'll say it's you know, the collapse of capitalism or whatever. But there is something happening at a grassroots level which is a bit harder to track. That Trump is manipulating, just in the same as so many other, you know, popular politicians do.
That's right. I think we're seeing this in many, many places. And I think what we're seeing in common in parts of Europe and the US and Australia and elsewhere at the moment is not only this kind of populist anger and populist volatility, but the consistent inability of pollsters and the elite class to understand what the grassroots thinks. It's extremely interesting. Poll after poll after poll in so many Western elections in the last 5 or 10 years have got it completely wrong, which suggests that we've got old school methodologies that aren't capturing actually what people at the grassroots think these days. And I was speaking to an election statistician the other day about precisely this problem. And she said that she thinks one of the key reasons is that so much polling is based on surveying people who voted last time. And so much surveying today is not speaking to people for whom voting has not been a part of their life. And what's really interesting, I think, particularly in the US at the moment, is that there is a battle going on for the hearts and minds of people who previously have not voted. And it may be that constituency that tends not to be polled that might actually swing the result. And so I think we're going to have to spend a lot more time listening to that constituency, because they're going to matter here.
And just a footnote that, do you think, you know, in a way, though, what's interesting is, I wonder, many of these kind of liberal social democrat governments around the world have kind of managed to get their way because people were so disaffected by, you know, on the far right or on the populist side that they didn't vote. Now, what's happening now is, for the first time, these people, they want to get their vote out. And that is the thing that is upsetting all the numbers, I think, because, you know, we depended on these people saying, you know, politics doesn't interest me, it's not for me, you know, none of these. Now they've got people who, you know, who kind of ignore everybody else. You know, they are the object of their minds.
And everybody made a big deal about Obama's grassroots mobilization at the last two elections, and rightly so. It seemed to be, you know, a new phenomenon in Western politics. But actually, what we've perhaps not paid enough attention to is that right-wing parties have got much better at this. And we've seen it with UKIP, we've seen it with the Leave campaign, we've seen it with the Tea Party, and Trump increasingly, I think, is realizing that this is going to be important for his campaign too. So you can mobilize that right-wing anger at the grassroots today in a way that perhaps it wasn't possible 10 or 15 years ago, or at least wasn't being done 10 or 15 years ago.
Just a quick one, we've got more to pack in, but Mary, just on that, on understanding that voting story. So in a way, the Democrats, you know, their connection with the working class is often through like the unions and through kind of like neighbourhoods and, you know, good solid things. Do you think the Democrats have failed here in a sense, though, if we are seeing this move towards Trump, that, you know, just as, you know, the mainstream political parties in Europe have failed to do, that they haven't paid enough attention to those areas of the country where people are dirt poor, they're not caught up in a nice way by, you know, a social net when things go wrong, that they have been neglected for too long?
Well, I think it's definitely true that they've been neglected for too long. But the assumption that they would vote Democrat if they actually voted, I think is probably not correct, because they were so far out of the political mainstream that they have had this sense of being lost and angry on the periphery for a very long time, but it never occurred to them. I mean, that there simply wasn't a candidate who even came near to representing any of their interests. And I think one of Hillary Clinton's problems is that she is so identified now, even more than most Democratic candidates in the past. She is so identified with the establishment and the administration and Washington. Even though, interestingly, her husband, when Bill Clinton became president, he was seen as the real outsider, the populist, the guy from Arkansas who could never really make it. He proved people wrong, but Hillary now looks like the establishment candidate, and in 2016, that looks like a liability.
Well, we're going to do a tiny, tiny break now, but when we come back, we're going to be talking Nice.
Our ideas-packed Entrepreneur's Guide. The design directory for people who want to build a better home. The style guide for getting to grips with the business of looking good. The soft power survey the Travel Top 50. Monocle magazine has a superlative lineup of survey reports and investigations coming your way. And to make sure that you never miss an issue, you just need to do one thing: become a Monocle subscriber. Not only will you get all of this great journalism, you'll also have free access to our full archive of stories online, receive invites to subscriber events around the world, and be sent a free gift too. Go to monocle.com/subscribe to join us today.
Welcome back to Midori House. Still with me, of course, are Phil Clark and Mary Jajewski. The French Prime Minister, Manuel Valls, has been booed today as he attended a minute's silence in Nice for the victims of Thursday's lorry attack, in which 84 people were killed. The crowd's disquiet stems from a perception that the French government has not done enough to ensure attacks of this kind are prevented. People in the crowd also called Valls a murderer and demanded he resign. Mary, you know, a baying crowd is not always to be relied on, especially in these sensitive moments, but there is disquiet. Again, you're touching on these points. You know, there's a disquiet amongst the, you know, the broad mass of people, you know, a broad mass who, a big chunk of which may vote on the right, that the government in Paris does not have a clue what's going on the ground.
Yes, and I mean, it reminded me so much listening to the booze. You could almost imagine that it was predictable that you would have people on the street booing the Prime Minister when he deigned to come down to Paris and look at the catastrophe, the aftermath of the catastrophe. But it reminded me, you know, you say that all these sort of connections elsewhere. But when Andy Murray won Wimbledon, he identified David Cameron, who by then had resigned as Prime Minister but was still Prime Minister, who was there in the crowd with his mother. And he sort of said, you know, it was nice to have the Prime Minister come and see him play. At which point, boos ran around the court, and to me this was completely extraordinary, because your Wimbledon crowd is not a street crowd in Nice. And I think this says something about the hostility towards politicians and leading politicians generally, even though there was obviously a very specific reason why people were booing the French Prime Minister in Nice.
Phil, you know, put it mildly, some of the kind of, you know, actually some of the really good analysis of what happened in Nice said, you know, that the attacker was probably a little bit unhinged, you know, hard to track. There's a report today he only grew a beard in the last week. You know, he wasn't that bothered about even appearing to be, you know, a fundamentalist. How on earth could they have caught him? Let's get into that. But isn't it without justification laying it all at the door of a French Prime Minister and a French government who, you know, they have stopped many of these attacks, but they are facing a war on many, many fronts, as they describe it.
Yeah, there are almost two separate things going on here. There's this public anger about a perceived lack of security and the failure of the government to protect civilians, which seems really widespread across France. But then you also have, I think, this really frightening possibility that perhaps this was not an organized attack, that even though ISIS have claimed responsibility for it, I mean, the evidence, I think, is yet to fully come out, but it does seem like this may have been a lone wolf. And in fact, I don't really like that phrase, but because I think it's become such a sort of cliche of these sorts of attacks. But increasingly, it does look like this was an individual, perhaps operating in a very small network of friends and colleagues, who used something very mundane like a truck to plow through a crowd. And that's the kind of thing that really no government is going to be able to stop. This is, you know, I saw one phrase the other day that this was the kind of weaponization of vehicles, that very, very basic objects are being turned into these kind of weapons of mass destruction. And that's going to be difficult for any security force to tackle, but particularly the French security force, which, coming back to the first point, does seem very fragmented, very disorganized, and at the moment the target of serious popular anger.
And Mary, we only have a few seconds left, but interestingly, when you look at this story, if I was an American on the right, I might say, okay, hold on. So you're saying if we get rid of all our guns, we won't get people killed on our streets. Here we have like 84 people killed by a truck. And in fact, the gentleman was only stopped because someone did have a gun.
Yes, and this is the prime argument of the American gun lobby, which says that if everybody were armed and everybody were prepared to use their weapons, then the crime rate would fall drastically. So there is a defence there. But I think one of the more interesting aspects of the Nice disaster was that there's actually so far no identifiable evidence that links this character to Islam, other than the fact that he was a Tunisian native with right of residency in France. There is nothing to suggest a religious motive that I've seen. There is plenty to suggest that he was unbalanced and that he had a grudge against society at large. And unfortunately, there may actually not be a link here. It may be something as absolutely basic as this.
Well, Mary, thank you very much. That's all we have. That was, of course, Phil Clark and Mary Jasewski. Today's show was produced by Tom Hall, research by Fernando Augusto Pacheco, and also by Jimena Minan, and also by Jacob Ladorna. But from me, Andrew Tuck, thank you very much for listening. Have a good evening and goodbye.